fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app.
Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Chapter 11 of The Mystery of Edwin Drood. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alan Chant. The Mystery of Edwin Drood, the unfinished novel by Charles Dickens. Chapter 11. A Picture and a Ring. Behind the most ancient part of Holborn, London, where certain gabled houses, some centuries of age, still stand looking on the public way, as if disconsolately looking for the old bourne that has long run dry, is a little nook, composed of two irregular quadrangles called Staple Inn. It is one of those nooks, the turning into which, out of the clashing street, imparts to the relieved pedestrian the sensation of having put cotton in his ears and velvet soles on his boots. It is one of those nooks where a few smoky sparrows twitter in smoky streets, as though they called to one another, "Let us play at country," and where a few feet of garden mould and a few yards of gravel enable them to do that refreshing violence to their tiny understandings. Moreover, it is one of those nooks which are legal nooks, and it contains a little hall with a little lantern in its roof, to what obstructive purpose is devoted, and at whose expense, this history knoweth not. In the days when Cloisterham took offence at the existence of a railroad afar off, as menacing that sensitive constitution the property of us Britons, the odd fortune of which sacred institution it is to be in exactly equal degrees croaked about, trembled for, and boasted of, whatever happens to anything, anywhere in the world, in those days no neighbouring architecture of lofty proportions had arisen to overshadow Staple Inn. The westering sun bestowed bright glances on it, and the southwest wind blew into it unimpeded. Neither wind nor sun, however, favoured Staple Inn one December afternoon towards 6 o'clock, when it was filled with fog, and candles shed murky and blurred rays through the windows of all its then-occupied sets of chambers, notably from a set of chambers in a corner-house in the little inner quadrangle, presenting in black and white over its ugly portal the mysterious inscription, P. J. T. 1747. In which set of chambers, never having troubled his head about the inscription, unless to bethink himself at odd times of glancing up at it, that happily it might mean, "Perhaps John Thomas," or "Perhaps Joe Tyler," sat Mr. Grewgious, writing by his fire. Who could have told, by looking at Mr. Grewgious, whether he had ever known ambition or disappointment? He had been bred to the bar, and had laid himself out for chamber practice, to draw deeds, convey the wise it call, as Pistol says. But conveyancing and he had made such a very indifferent marriage of it, that they had separated by consent, if there can be said to be separation, where there has never been coming together. No, coy conveyancing would not come to Mr. Grewgious. She was wooed, not won, and they went their several ways. But an arbitration being blown towards him by some unaccountable wind, and he gaining great credit in it as one indefatigable in seeking out right and doing right, a pretty fat receivership was next blown into his pocket by a wind more traceable to its source. So, by chance, he had found his niche. receiver and agent now to two rich estates, and deputing their legal business, in an amount worth having, to a firm of solicitors on the floor below, he had snuffed out his ambition, supposing him to have ever lighted it, and had settled down with his snuffers for the rest of his life under the dry vine and fig tree of P. J. T., who planted in 1747. Many accounts and account books, many files of correspondence, and several strong boxes garnished Mr. Grewgious's room. They can scarcely be represented as having lumbered it, so conscientious and precise was their orderly arrangement. The apprehension of dying suddenly, and leaving one fact or one figure, with any incompleteness or obscurity attaching to it, would have stretched Mr. Grewgious stone-dead any day. The largest fidelity to a trust was the life-blood of the man. There are sorts of life-blood that course more quickly, more gaily, more attractively, but there is no better sort in circulation. There was no luxury in his room. Even its comforts were limited to its being dry and warm, and having a snug though faded fireside. What may be called its private life was confined to the hearth, an old easy-chair, and an old-fashioned occasional round table that was brought out upon the rug after business hours from a corner where it elsewise remained turned up like a shining mahogany shield. Behind it, when standing thus on the defensive, was a closet, usually containing something good to drink. An outer room was the clerk's room. Mr. Grewgious's sleeping room was across the common stair, and he held some not empty cellarage at the bottom of the common stair. 300 days in the year, at least, he crossed over to the hotel in Furnival's Inn for his dinner, and after dinner crossed back again, to make the most of these simplicities, until it should become broad business day once more, with P.J.T., date 1747. As Mr. Grewgious sat and wrote by his fire that afternoon, so did the clerk of Mr. Grewgious sit and write by his fire. A pale, puffy-faced, dark-haired person of 30, with big dark eyes that wholly wanted lustre, and a dissatisfied doughy complexion that seemed to ask to be sent to the baker's, this attendant was a mysterious being, possessed of some strange power over Mr. Grewgious. As though he had been called into existence, like a fabulous familiar, by a magic spell which had failed when required to dismiss him, he stuck tight to Mr. Grewgious's stool, although Mr. Grewgious's comfort and convenience would manifestly have been advanced by dispossessing him. A gloomy person, with tangled locks, and a general air of having been reared under the shadow of that baleful tree of Java which has given shelter to more lies than the whole botanical kingdom, Mr. Grewgious, nevertheless, treated him with unaccountable consideration. "Now, Bazzard," said Mr. Grewgious, on the entrance of his clerk, looking up from his papers as he arranged them for the night, "what is in the wind besides fog?"
"Mr. Drood," said Bazzard.
"What of him?"
"Has called," said Bazzard.
"You might have shown him in."
"I am doing it," said Bazzard.
The visitor came in accordingly. "Dear me," said Mr. Grewgious, looking round his pair of office candles, "I thought you had called and merely left your name and gone. How do you do, Mr. Edwin? Dear me, you're choking."
"It's this fog," returned Edwin, "and it makes my eyes smart like cayenne pepper."
"Is it really so bad as that? Pray, undo your wrappers. It's fortunate I have so good a fire. But Mr. Bazzard has taken care of me."
"No, I haven't," said Mr. Bazzard at the door.
"Ah, then it follows that I must have taken care of myself without observing it," said Mr. Grewgious. "Pray be seated in my chair. No, no, I beg. coming out of such an atmosphere, in my chair." Edwin took the easy chair in the corner, and the fog he had brought in with him, and the fog he took off with his great coat and neck shawl, was speedily licked up by the eager fire. "I look," said Edwin, smiling, "as if I had come to stop." "By the by," cried Mr. Grewgious, "excuse my interrupting you. Do stop. The fog may clear in an hour or so. We can have dinner in from just across Holborn. You had better take your cayenne pepper here than outside. Pray stop and dine." "You are very kind," said Edwin, glancing about him as though attracted by the notion of a new and relishing sort of gypsy party. "Not at all," said Mr. Grewgious. "You are very kind to join issue with a bachelor in chambers and take potluck." "And I'll ask," said Mr. Grewgious, dropping his voice and speaking with a twinkling eye, as if inspired by a bright thought, "I'll ask Bazzard. He mightn't like it else." "Bazzard?" Bazzard appeared. "Dine presently with Mr. Drood and me."
"If I am ordered to dine, of course I will, sir," was the gloomy answer.
"Save the man," cried Mr. Grewgious. "You're not ordered, you're invited."
"Thank you, sir," said Bazzard. "In that case, I don't care if I do."
"That's arranged. And perhaps you wouldn't mind," said Mr. Grewgious, "stepping over to the hotel at Furnival's, and asking them to send in materials for laying the cloth. For dinner we'll have a tureen of the hottest and strongest soup available, and we'll have the best made dish that can be recommended, and we'll have a joint, such as a haunch of mutton, and we'll have a goose or a turkey, or any little stuffed thing of that sort that may happen to be in the bill of fare. In short, we'll have whatever there is on hand." These liberal directions Mr. Grewgious issued with his usual air of reading an inventory, or repeating a lesson, or doing anything else by rote. Bazzard, after drawing out the round table, withdrew to execute them. "It was a little delicate, you see," said Mr. Grewgious in a lower tone after his clerk's departure, "about employing him in the foraging or commissariat department, because he mightn't like it."
"He seems to have his own way, sir," remarked Edwin.
"His own way?" returned Mr. Grewgious. "Oh, dear no, poor fellow, you quite mistake him. If he had his own way, he wouldn't be here."
"I wonder where he would be," Edwin thought. But he only thought it because Mr. Grewgious came and stood beside him with his back to the other corner of the fire, and his shoulder-blades against the chimney-piece, and collected his skirts for easy conversation.
"I take it that, without having the gift of prophecy, that you have done me the favour of looking in to mention that you are going down yonder, where I can tell you you are expected, and to offer to execute any little commission from me to my charming ward, and perhaps to sharpen me up a bit in any proceedings, eh, Mr. Edwin?"
"I called before going down as an act of attention."
"Of attention," said Mr. Grewgious. "Of course. Not of impatience?"
"Impatience, sir?" Mr. Grewgious had meant to be arch, not that he in the remotest degree expressed that meaning, and had brought himself into scarcely supportable proximity with the fire, as if to burn the fullest effect of his archness into himself, as other subtle impressions are burnt into hard metals. But his archness suddenly flying before the composed face and manner of his visitor, and only the fire remaining, he started and rubbed himself down.
"I have lately been down yonder," said Mr. Grewgious, rearranging his skirts, "and That was what I referred to when I said I could tell you you are expected.
Indeed, sir. Yes, I knew that Pussy was looking out for me.
Do you keep a cat down there? Asked Mr. Grewgious. Edwin coloured a little as he explained.
I call Rosa Pussy.
Oh, really, said Mr. Grewgious, smoothing down his head. That's very affable. Edwin glanced at his face, uncertain whether or no he seriously objected to the appellation. But Edwin might as well have glanced at the face of a clock.
A pet name, sir, he explained again.
Hm, said Mr. Grewgious with a nod. But with such an extraordinary compromise between an unqualified assent and a qualified dissent, that his visitor was much disconcerted.
Did Rosa?
Edwin began by way of recovering himself.
Rosa?
Repeated Mr. Grewgious.
I was going to say Pussy, and change my mind. Did she tell you anything about the Landlesses?
No, said Mr. Grewgious. What is the Landlesses? An estate? A villa? A farm?
A brother and sister. The sister is at the nun's house, and has become a great friend of her...
Rosa's? Mr. Grewgious stuck in, with a fixed face.
She is a strikingly handsome girl, sir, and I thought she might have been described to you, or presented to you, perhaps.
Neither, said Mr. Grewgious, but here is Bazzard. Bazzard returned, accompanied by two waiters, an immovable waiter and a flying waiter, and the three brought in with them as much fog, and gave a new roar to the fire. The flying waiter, who had brought everything on his shoulders, laid the cloth with amazing rapidity and dexterity, while the immovable waiter, who had brought nothing, found fault with him. The flying waiter then highly polished all the glasses he had brought, and the immovable waiter looked through them. The flying waiter then flew across Holborn for the soup, and flew back again, and then took another flight for the maid dish, and flew back again, and then took another flight for the joint and poultry, and flew back again, and between whiles took supplementary flights for a great variety of articles, as it was discovered from time to time that the immovable waiter had forgotten them all. But let the flying waiter cleave the air as he might, he was always reproached on his return by the immovable waiter for bringing fog with him and being out of breath. At the conclusion of the repast, by which time the flying waiter was severely blown, the immovable waiter gathered up the tablecloth under his arm with a grand air, and having sternly, not to say with indignation, looked on at the flying waiter while he set the clean glasses round, directed a valedictory glance towards Mr. Grewgious, conveying,
"Let it be clearly understood between us that the reward is mine, and that nil is the claim of this slave,"
and pushed the flying waiter before him out of the room. It was like a highly finished miniature painting representing my lords of the circumlocution department, commandership in chief of any sort, government. It was quite an edifying little picture to be hung on the line in the National Gallery. As the fog had been the proximate cause of this sumptuous repast, so the fog served for its general source. To hear the outdoor clerks sneezing, wheezing, and beating their feet on the gravel was a zest far surpassing Dr. Kitchener's. To bid, with a shiver, the unfortunate flying waiter shut the door, before he had opened it, was a condiment of a profounder flavour than Harvey's. And here let it be noticed, parenthetically, that the leg of this young man, in its application to the door, evinced the finest sense of touch, always preceding himself and tray, with something of an angling air about it, by some seconds, and always lingering after he and the tray had disappeared, like Macbeth's leg when accompanying him off the stage with reluctance to the assassination of Duncan. The host had gone below to the cellar, and had brought up bottles of ruby, straw-coloured, and golden drinks, which had ripened long ago in lands where no fogs are, and had since lain slumbering in the shade. Sparkling and tingling after so long a nap, they pushed at their corks to help the corkscrew, like prisoners helping rioters to force their gates, and danced out gaily. If P.J.T. in 1747, or any other year of his period, drank such wines, then for a certainty P.J.T. was pretty jolly too. Externally, Mr. Grewgious showed no signs of being mellowed by these glowing vintages. Instead of his drinking them, they might have been poured over him in his highly dried snuff form and run to waste, for any lights and shades they caused to flicker over his face. Neither was his manner influenced. But in his wooden way he had observant eyes for Edwin, and when, at the end of the dinner, he motioned Edwin back to his own easy chair in the fireside corner, and Edwin sank luxuriously into it after very brief remonstrance, Mr. Grewgious, as he turned his head round towards the fire too, and smoothed his head and face, might have been seen looking at his visitor between his smoothing fingers. "Bazzard," said Mr. Grewgious, suddenly turning to him.
"I follow you, sir," returned Bazzard, who had done his work of consuming meat and drink in a workmanlike manner, though mostly in speechlessness.
"I drink to you, Bazzard. Mr. Edwin, success to Mr. Bazzard."
"Success to Mr. Bazzard," echoed Edwin, with a totally unfounded appearance of enthusiasm, and with the unspoken addition, "What inn, I wonder?"
"And may," pursued Mr. Grewgious, "I am not at liberty to be definite, may, my conversational powers are so very limited that I know I shall not come well out of this, may, it ought to be put imaginatively, but I have no imagination, may, the thorn of anxiety is as nearly the mark as I am likely to get, may it come out at last."
Mr. Bazzard, with a frowning smile at the fire, put a hand into his tangled locks, as if the thorn of anxiety were there, then into his waistcoat, as if it were there, then into his pockets, as if it were there. In all these movements he was closely followed by the eyes of Edwin, as if that young gentleman expected to see the thorn in action. It was not produced, however, and Mr. Bazzard merely said,
"I follow you, sir, and I thank you."
"I am going," said Mr. Grewgious, jingling his glass on the table with one hand, and bending aside under cover of the other to whisper to Edwin, "to drink to my ward. But I put Bazzard first. He mightn't like it else."
This was said with a mysterious wink, or what would have been a wink if, in Mr. Grewgious's hands, it could have been quick enough. So Edwin winked responsively, without the least idea what he meant by doing so.
"And now," said Mr. Grewgious, "I devote a bumper to the fair and fascinating Miss Rosa. Bazzard, the fair and fascinating Miss Rosa."
"I follow you, sir," said Bazzard, "and I pledge you."
"And so do I," said Edwin. "Lord bless me," cried Mr. Grewgious, breaking the blank silence which of course ensued,
though why these pauses should come upon us when we have performed any small social rite, not directly inducive of self-examination or mental despondency, who can tell?
"I am a particularly angular man, and I fancy, if I may use the word, not having a morsel of fancy, that I could draw the picture of a true lover's state of mind to-night."
"Let us follow you, sir,"
said Bazzard, "and have the picture."
"Mr. Edwin will correct it where it's wrong," resumed Mr. Grewgious, "and will throw in a few touches from the life. I dare say it is wrong in many particulars, and wants many touches from the life. For I was born a chip, and have neither soft sympathies nor soft experiences. Well, I hazard the guess that the true lover's mind is completely permeated by the beloved object of his affections. I hazard the guess that her dear name is precious to him, cannot be heard or repeated without emotion, and is preserved sacred. If he has any distinguishing appellation of fondness for her, it is reserved for her, and is not for common ears. A name that would be a privilege to call her by, being alone with her own bright self, it would be a liberty, a coldness, an insensibility, almost a breach of good faith, to flaunt elsewhere." It was wonderful to see Mr. Grewgious sitting bolt upright, with his hands on his knees, continuously chopping this discourse out of himself, much as a charity boy with a very good memory might get his catechism said, and evincing no correspondent emotion whatever, unless in a certain occasional little tingling perceptible at the end of his nose. "My picture," Mr. Grewgious proceeded, "goes on to represent, under correction from you, Mr. Edwin, the true lover as ever impatient to be in the presence or vicinity of the beloved object of his affections, as caring very little for his case in any other society, and as constantly seeking that. If I was to say seeking that as a bird seeks its nest, I should make an ass of myself, because that would trench upon what I understand to be poetry, and I am so far from trenching upon poetry at any time, that I never, to my knowledge, got within 10,000 miles of it. And I am, besides, totally unacquainted with the habits of birds, except the birds of Staple Inn, who seek their nests on ledges, and in gutter pipes, and chimney pots, not constructed for them by the beneficent hand of nature. I beg, therefore, to be understood as foregoing the bird's nest. But my picture does represent the true lover as having no existence separate from that of the beloved object of his affections, and as living at once a doubled life and a halved life. And if I do not clearly express what I mean by that, it is either for the reason that having no conversational powers I cannot express what I mean, or that having no meaning I do not mean what I fail to express, which, to the best of my belief, is not the case." Edwin had turned red, and turned white as certain points of this picture came into the light. He now sat looking at the fire, and bit his lip. "The speculations of an angular man," resumed Mr. Grewgious, still sitting and speaking exactly as before, "are probably erroneous on so globular a topic. But I figure to myself, subject as before to Mr. Edwin's correction, that there can be no coolness, no lassitude, no doubt, no indifference, no half-fire and half-smoke state of mind in a real lover. Pray, am I at all near the mark in my picture?" As abrupt in his conclusion as in his commencement and progress, he jerked this inquiry at Edwin, and stopped where one might have supposed him to be in the middle of his oration.
"I should say, sir," stammered Edwin, "as you refer the question to me—"
"Yes," said Mr. Grewgious,
I refer it to you as an authority. I should say then, sir, Edwin went on, embarrassed, that the picture you have drawn is generally correct, but I submit that perhaps you may be rather hard upon the unlucky lover.
Likely so, assented Mr. Grewgious, likely so. I am a hard man in the grain.
He may not show, said Edwin, all he feels, or he may not...
There he stopped so long to find the rest of his sentence that Mr. Grewgious rendered his difficulty a thousand times the greater by unexpectedly striking in with,
No, to be sure, he may not.
After that they all sat silent, the silence of Mr. Bazzard being occasioned by slumber.
His responsibility is very great, though, said Mr. Grewgious at length with his eyes on the fire.
Edwin nodded assent, with his eyes on the fire.
And let him be sure that he trifles with no one, said Mr. Grewgious, neither with himself nor with any other.
Edwin bit his lip again, and still sat looking at the fire.
He must not make a plaything of a treasure. Woe betide him if he does. Let him take that well to heart, said Mr. Grewgious.
Though he said these things in short sentences, much as the supposititious charity boy just now referred to might have repeated a verse or two from the Book of Proverbs, there was something dreamy, for so literal a man, in the way in which he now shook his right forefinger at the live coals in the grate, and again fell silent. But not for long. As he sat upright and stiff in his chair, he suddenly rapped his knees like the carved image of some queer joss or other coming out of its reverie, and said,
"We must finish this bottle, Mr. Edwin. Let me help you. I'll help Bazzard too, though he is asleep. He mightn't like it else."
He helped them both, and helped himself, and drained his glass and stood it bottom upward on the table, as though he had just caught a bluebottle in it.
"And now, Mr. Edwin,"
he proceeded, wiping his mouth and hands upon his handkerchief,
"to a little piece of business. You received from me the other day a certified copy of Miss Rosa's father's will. You knew its contents before, but you received it from me as a matter of business. I should have sent it to Mr. Jasper, but for Miss Rosa's wishing it to come straight to you in preference. You received it?"
"Quite safely, sir."
"You should have acknowledged its receipt," said Mr. Grewgious. "Business being business all the world over. However, you did not."
"I meant to have acknowledged it when I first came in this evening."
"Not a business-like acknowledgment," returned Mr. Grewgious. "However, let that pass. Now, in that document, you have observed a few words of kindly allusion to its being left to me to discharge a little trust, confided to me in conversation, at such time as I, in my discretion, may think best."
"Yes, sir."
"Mr. Edwin, it came into my mind just now, when I was looking at the fire, that I could, in my discretion, acquit myself of that trust at no better time than the present. Favour me with your attention, half a minute."
He took a bunch of keys from his pocket, singled out by the candlelight the key he wanted, and then with a candle in his hand went to a bureau or escritoire, unlocked it, touched the spring of a little secret drawer, and took from it an ordinary ring-case made for a single ring. With this in his hand he returned to his chair. As he held it up for the young man to see, his hand trembled.
"Mr. Edwin, this rose of diamonds and rubies, delicately set in gold, was a ring belonging to Miss Rosa's mother.
it was removed from her dead hand, in my presence, with such distracted grief as I hope it may never be my lot to contemplate again. Hard man as I am not hard enough for that. See how bright these stones shine, opening the case. And yet the eyes that were so much brighter, and that so often looked upon them with a light and a proud heart, have been ashes among ashes, and dust among dust, some years. If I had any imagination, which it is needless to say I have not, I might imagine that the lasting beauty of these stones was almost cruel. He closed the case again as he spoke. The ring was given to the young lady who was drowned so early in her beautiful and happy career by her husband when they first plighted their faith to one another. It was he who removed it from her unconscious hand, and it was he who, when his death drew very near, placed it in mine. The trust in which I received it was that you and Miss Rosa, growing to manhood and womanhood, and your betrothal prospering and coming to maturity, I should give it to you to place upon her finger. Failing those desired results, it was to remain in my possession. Some trouble was in the young man's face, and some indecision was in the action of his hand, as Mr. Grewgious, looking steadfastly at him, gave him the ring. "Your placing it on her finger," said Mr. Grewgious, "will be the solemn seal upon your strict fidelity to the living and the dead. You are going to her to make the last irrevocable preparations for your marriage. Take it with you." The young man took the little case and placed it in his breast. "If anything should be amiss, if anything should be even slightly wrong between you, if you should have any secret consciousness that you are committing yourself to this step for no higher reason than because you have long been accustomed to look forward to it, then," said Mr. Grewgious, "I charge you once more, by the living and by the dead, to bring that ring back to me." Here Bazzard awoke himself by his own snoring, and, as is usual in such cases, sat apoplectically staring at vacancy, as defying vacancy to accuse him of having been asleep. "Bazzard," said Mr. Grewgious, harder than ever.
"I follow you, sir," said Bazzard, "and I have been following you."
"In discharge of a trust, I have handed Mr. Edwin Drood a ring of diamonds and rubies, you see."
Edwin reproduced the little case and opened it, and Bazzard looked into it.
"I follow you both, sir," returned Bazzard, "and I witness the transaction."
Evidently anxious to get away and be alone, Edwin Drood now resumed his outer clothing, muttering something about time and appointments. The fog was reported no clearer by the flying waiter, who alighted from a speculative flight in the coffee interest. But he went out into it, and Bazzard, after his manner, followed him. Mr. Grewgious, left alone, walked softly and slowly to and fro for an hour or more. He was restless tonight, and seemed dispirited.
"I hope I have done right," he said. "The appeal to him seemed necessary. It was hard to lose the ring, and yet it must have gone from me very soon."
He closed the empty little drawer with a sigh, and shut and locked the escritoire, and came back to the solitary fireside.
"Her ring," he went on, "will it come back to me? My mind hangs about her ring very uneasily to-night. But that is explainable. I have had it so long, and I have prized it so much. I wonder."
He was in a wondering mood as well as a restless, for though he checked himself at that point and took another walk, he resumed his wondering where he sat down again.
"I wonder, for the 10,000th time, and what a weak fool I, for what can it signify now, whether he confided the charge of their orphan child to me, because he knew, good God, how like her mother she has become. I wonder whether he ever so much as suspected that someone doted on her at a hopeless, speechless distance when he struck in and won her. I wonder whether it ever crept into his mind who that unfortunate someone was. I wonder whether I shall sleep tonight. At all events, I will shut out the world with the bedclothes, and try."
Mr. Grewgious crossed the staircase to his raw and foggy bedroom, and was soon ready for bed. Dimly catching sight of his face in the misty looking-glass, he held his candle to it for a moment.
"A likely someone, you, to come into anybody's thoughts in such an aspect," he exclaimed. "There, there, there. Get to bed, poor man, and cease to jabber."
With that, he extinguished his light, pulled up the bedclothes around him, and with another sigh shut out the world. And yet there are such unexplored romantic nooks in the unlikeliest men, that even old Tinderous and Touchwoody P.J.T. possibly jabbered thus, at some odd times, in or about 1747.
End of chapter 11.
Read by Alan Chant of Tunbridge in Kent, England, during 2008.
Chapter 12 of The Mystery of Edwin Drood. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alan Chant. The Mystery of Edwin Drood, the unfinished novel by Charles Dickens. Chapter 12. A Night with Durdles. When Mr. Sapsea has nothing better to do, towards evening, and finds the contemplation of his own profundity becoming a little monotonous, in spite of the vastness of the subject, he often takes an airing in the Cathedral Close and thereabout. He likes to pass the churchyard with a swelling air of proprietorship, and to encourage in his breast a sort of benignant landlord feeling, in that he has been bountiful towards that meritorious tenant, Mrs. Sapsea, and has publicly given her a prize. He likes to see a stray face or two looking in through the railings, and perhaps reading his inscription. Should he meet a stranger coming from the churchyard with a quick step, he is morally convinced that the stranger is, with a blush, retiring, as monumentally directed. Mr. Sapsea's importance has received enhancement, for he has become mayor of Cloisterham. Without mayors, and many of them, it cannot be disputed that the whole framework of society—Mr. Sapsea is confident that he invented that forcible figure—would fall to pieces. Mayors have been knighted for going up with addresses, explosive machines intrepidly discharging shot and shell into the English grammar. Mr. Sapsea may go up with an address. Rise, Sir Thomas Sapsea. Of such is the salt of the earth. Mr. Sapsea has improved the acquaintance of Mr. Jasper since their first meeting to partake of port, epitaph, backgammon, beef, and salad. Mr. Sapsea has been received at the gatehouse with kindred hospitality, and on that occasion Mr. Jasper seated himself at the piano and sang to him, tickling his ears, figuratively, long enough to present a considerable area for tickling. What Mr. Sapsea likes in that young man is that he is always ready to profit by the wisdom of his elders, and that he is sound, sir, at the core, in proof of which he sang to Mr. Sapsea that evening no kickshaw ditties, favourites with national enemies, but gave him the genuine George the Third home-brewed, exhorting him as my brave boys to reduce to a smashed condition all other islands but this island, and all continents, peninsulas, isthmuses, promontories, and other geographical forms of land soever, besides sweeping the seas in all directions. In short, he rendered it pretty clear that Providence made a distinct mistake in originating so small a nation of hearts of oak, and so many other verminous peoples. Mr. Sapsea, walking slowly this moist evening near the churchyard, with his hands behind him, on the lookout for a blushing and retiring stranger, turns a corner, and comes instead into the goodly presence of the Dean, conversing with the verger and Mr. Jasper. Mr. Sapsea makes his obeisance, and is instantly stricken far more ecclesiastical than any Archbishop of York or Canterbury. "You are evidently going to write a book about us, Mr. Jasper," quoth the Dean. "To write a book about us? Well, we are very ancient, and we ought to make a good book. We are not so richly endowed in possessions as in age, but perhaps you will put that in your book, amongst other things, and call attention to our wrongs." Mr. Tope, as in duty bound, is greatly entertained by this. "I really have no intention at all, sir," replies Jasper, "of turning author or archaeologist. It is but a whim of mine, and even for my whim Mr. Sapsea here is more accountable than I am." "How so, Mr. Mayor?" says the Dean, with a nod of good-natured recognition of his fetch. "How is that, Mr. Mayor?"
"I am not aware," Mr. Sapsea remarks, looking about him for information, "to what the very reverend the Dean does me the honour of referring,"
and then falls to studying his original in minute points of detail. "Durdles?" Mr. Tope hints.
"Ah," the Dean echoes, "Durdles, Durdles."
"The truth is, sir," explains Jasper, "that my curiosity in the man was first really stimulated by Mr. Sapsea. Mr. Sapsea's knowledge of mankind, and power of drawing out whatever is recluse or odd around him, first led to my bestowing a second thought upon the man, though, of course, I had met him constantly about. You would not be surprised by this, Mr. Dean, if you had seen Mr. Sapsea deal with him in his own parlour, as I did."
"Oh!"
cries Sapsea, picking up the ball thrown to him with ineffable complacency and pomposity.
"Yes, yes, the very reverend the Dean refers to that. Yes, I happened to bring Durdles and Mr. Jasper together. I regard Durdles as a character."
"A character, Mr. Sapsea, that with a few skilful touches you turn inside out," says Jasper.
"Nay, not quite that," returns the lumbering auctioneer. "I may have a little influence over him, perhaps, and a little insight into his character, perhaps. The very reverend the Dean will please to bear in mind that I have seen the world."
Here Mr. Sapsea gets a little behind the Dean to inspect his coat buttons. "Well," says the Dean, looking about him to see what has become of his copyist,
I hope, Mr. Mayor, you will use your study and knowledge of Durdles to the good purpose of exhorting him not to break our worthy and respected choirmaster's neck. We cannot afford it. His head and voice are much too valuable to us."
Mr. Tope is again highly entertained, and having fallen into respectful convulsions of laughter, subsides into a deferential murmur, importing that surely any gentleman would deem it a pleasure and an honour to have his neck broken, in return for such a compliment from such a source.
"I will take it upon myself, sir," observes Sapsea loftily, "to answer for Mr. Jasper's neck. I will tell Durdles to be careful of it. He will mind what I say. How is it at present endangered?" he inquires, looking about him with magnificent patronage.
"Only by my making a moonlight expedition with Durdles among the tombs, vaults, towers, and ruins," returns Jasper. "You remember suggesting, when you brought us together, that, as a lover of the picturesque, it might be worth my while."
"I remember," replies the auctioneer,
and the solemn idiot really believes that he does remember. "Profiting by your hint," pursues Jasper, "I have had some day rambles with the extraordinary old fellow, and we are to make a moonlight hole-and-corner exploration to-night." "And here he is," says the Dean. Durdles, with his dinner bundle in his hand, is indeed beheld slouching towards them. Slouching nearer, and perceiving the Dean, he pulls off his hat, and is slouching away with it under his arm when Mr. Sapsea stops him.
"Mind you take care of my friend,"
is the injunction Mr. Sapsea lays upon him.
"What friend of yourn is dead?" asks Durdles. "No orders has come in for any friend of yourn." "I mean my live friend there." "Oh, him," says Durdles. "He can take care of himself, can Mr. Jasper." "But do you take care of him too," says Sapsea.
Whom Durdles, there being command in his tone, surlily surveys from head to foot.
"With submission to his reverence the Dean, if you'll mind what concerns you, Mr. Sapsea, Durdles, he'll mind what concerns him."
"You're out of temper," says Mr. Sapsea, winking to the company to observe how smoothly he will manage him.
"My friend concerns me, and Mr. Jasper is my friend, and you are my friend." "Don't you get into a bad habit of boasting," retorts Durdles, with a grave cautionary nod. "It'll grow upon you." "You are out of temper," says Sapsea again, reddening, but again winking to the company. "I own to it," returns Durdles. "I don't like liberties."
Mr. Sapsea winks a third wink to the company, as who should say,
"I think you will agree with me that I have settled his business,"
and stalks out of the controversy. Durdles then gives the Dean a good evening, and adding, as he puts his hat on,
"You'll find me at home, Mr. Jasper, as agreed, when you want me. I'm a-going home to clean myself,"
soon slouches out of sight. This going home to clean himself is one of the man's incomprehensible compromises with inexorable facts, he and his hat and his boots and his clothes never showing any trace of cleaning, but being uniformly in one condition of dust and grit. The lamplighter, now dotting the quiet clothes with specks of light, and running at a great rate up and down his little ladder with that object, his little ladder under the sacred shadow of whose inconvenience generations have grown up, and which all Cloisterham would have stood aghast at the idea of abolishing. The Dean withdraws to his dinner, Mr. Tope to his tea, and Mr. Jasper to his piano. There, with no light but that of the fire, he sits chanting choir music in a low and beautiful voice for 2 or 3 hours, in short, until it has been for some time dark and the moon is about to rise. Then he closes his piano softly, softly changes his coat for a pea jacket with a goodly wicker-cased bottle in its largest pocket, and putting on a low-crowned, flap-brimmed hat, goes softly out. Why does he move so softly tonight? No outward reason is apparent for it. Can there be any sympathetic reason crouching darkly within him? Repairing to Durdles' unfinished house or hole in the city wall, and seeing a light within it, he softly picks his course among the gravestones, monuments, and stony lumber of the yard, already touched here and there sidewise by the rising moon. The two journeymen have left their two great saws sticking in their blocks of stone, and two skeleton journeymen, out of the dance of death, might be grinning in the shadow of their sheltering sentry-boxes, about to slash away at cutting out the gravestones of the next two people destined to die in Cloisterham. Likely enough, the two think little of that now, being alive and perhaps merry. Curious to make a guess at the two, or say, one of the two.
Ho! Durdles!
The light moves, and he appears with it at the door. He would seem to have been cleaning himself with the aid of a bottle, jug, and tumbler, for no other cleansing instruments are visible in the bare brick room, with rafters overhead and no plastered ceiling, into which he shows his visitor.
Are you ready?
I am ready, Mr. Jasper. Let the old uns come out if they dare when we go among their tombs. My spirit is ready for 'em.
Do you mean animal spirits or ardent?
The one's the t'other, answers Durdles, and I mean 'em both.
He takes a lantern from a hook, puts a match or two in his pocket wherewith to light it should there be need, and they go out together, dinner bundle and all. Surely an unaccountable sort of expedition. That Durdles himself, who is always prowling among old graves and ruins like a ghoul, that he should be stealing forth to climb and dive and wander without an object is nothing extraordinary. But that the choirmaster, or any one else, should hold it worth his while to be with him, and to study moonlight effects in such company, is another affair. Surely an unaccountable sort of expedition, therefore.
Where that there mound by the yard gate, Mr. Jasper?
I see it. What is it?
Lime.
Mr. Jasper stops, and waits for him to come out, for he lags behind. What you call quicklime?
"Aye," says Durdles, "quick enough to eat your boots, with a little handy stirring, quick enough to eat your bones."
They go on, presently passing the red windows of the Traveller's Tuppenny, and emerging into the clear moonlight of the Monk's Vineyard. This crossed, they come to Minor Canon Corner, of which the greater part lies in shadow until the moon shall rise higher in the sky. The sound of a closing house-door strikes their ears, and two men come out. These are Mr. Crisparkle and Neville. Jasper, with a strange and sudden smile upon his face, lays the palm of his hand upon the breast of Durdles, stopping him where he stands. At that end of Minor Canon Corner, the shadow is profound in the existing state of the light. At that end, too, there is a piece of old dwarf wall breast-high, the only remaining boundary of what was once a garden, but is now the thoroughfare. Jasper and Durdles would have turned this wall in another instant, but stopping so short, stand behind it.
"These two are only sauntering," Jasper whispers. "They will go out into the moonlight soon. Let us keep quiet here, or they will detain us, or want to join us, or what not."
Durdles nods assent, and falls to munching some fragments from his bundle. Jasper folds his arms upon the top of the wall, and with his chin resting on them, watches. He takes no note whatever of the Minor Canon, but watches Neville, as though his eyes were at the trigger of a loaded rifle, and he had covered him, and were going to fire. A sense of destructive power is so expressed in his face that even Durdles pauses in his munching, and looks at him with an unmunched something in his cheek. Meanwhile Mr. Crisparkle and Neville walk to and fro, quietly talking together. What they say cannot be heard consecutively, but Mr. Jasper has already distinguished his own name more than once.
"This is the first day of the week,"
Mr. Crisparkle can be distinctly heard to observe as they turn back.
"And the last day of this week is Christmas Eve. You may be certain of me, sir."
The echoes were favourable at those points, but as the two approach, the sound of their talking becomes confused again. The word "confidence" shattered by the echoes, but still capable of being pieced together, is uttered by Mr. Crisparkle. As they draw still nearer, this fragment of a reply is heard.
"Not deserved yet, but shall be, sir."
As they turn away again, Jasper again hears his own name in connection with the words from Mr. Crisparkle.
"Remember that I said I answered for you confidently."
Then the sound of their talk becomes confused again, they halting for a little while, and some earnest action on the part of Neville succeeding. When they move once more, Mr. Crisparkle is seen to look up at the sky and to point before him. They then slowly disappear, passing out into the moonlight at the opposite end of the corner. It is not until they are gone that Mr. Jasper moves. But then he turns to Durdles and bursts into a fit of laughter. Durdles, who still has that suspended something in his cheek, and who sees nothing to laugh at, stares at him until Mr. Jasper lays his face down on his arms to have his laugh out. Then Durdles bolts the something, as if desperately resigning himself to indigestion. Among those secluded nooks there is very little stir of movement after dark. There is little enough in the high tide of the day, but there is next to none at night. Besides that, the cheerfully frequented High Street lies nearly parallel to the spot, the old cathedral rising between the two, and is the natural channel in which the Cloisterham traffic flows. A certain awful hush pervades the ancient pile, the cloisters and the churchyard after dark, which not many people care to encounter. Ask the first 100 citizens of Cloisterham, met at random in the streets at noon, if they believed in ghosts. They would tell you no. But put them to choose at night, between these eerie precincts and the thoroughfare of shops, and you would find that 99 declared for the longer round and the more frequented way. The cause of this is not to be found in any local superstition that attaches to the precincts, albeit a mysterious lady with a child in her arms and a rope dangling from her neck has been seen flitting about there by sundry witnesses as intangible as herself. But it is to be sought in the innate shrinking of dust with the breath of life in it, from dust out of which the breath of life has passed. Also, in the widely diffused, and almost as widely unacknowledged, reflection, if the dead do, under any circumstances, become visible to the living, these are such likely surroundings for the purpose that I, the living, will get out of them as soon as I can. Hence, when Mr. Jasper and Durdles pause to glance around them before descending into the crypt by a small side door, of which the latter has a key, the whole expanse of moonlight in their view is utterly deserted. One might fancy that the tide of life was stemmed by Mr. Jasper's own gatehouse. The murmur of the tide is heard beyond, but no wave passes the archway over which his lamp burns red behind his curtain, as if the building, were a lighthouse. They enter, locking themselves in, descend the rugged steps and are down in the crypt. The lantern is not wanted, for the moonlight strikes in at the groined windows bare of glass, the broken frames for which cast patterns on the ground. The heavy pillars which support the roof engender masses of black shade, but between them there are lanes of light. Up and down these lanes they walk, Durdles discoursing on the old uns he yet counts on disinterring, and slapping a wall in which he considers a whole family on 'em to be stoned and earthed up, just as if he were a familiar friend of the family. The taciturnity of Durdles is for the time overcome by Mr. Jasper's wicker bottle, which circulates freely, in the sense, that is to say, that its contents enter freely into Mr. Durdles' circulation, while Mr. Jasper only rinses his mouth once, and casts forth the rinsing. They are to ascend the great tower. On the steps by which they rise to the cathedral, Durdles pauses for new store of breath. The steps are very dark, but out of the darkness they can see the lanes of light they have traversed. Durdles seats himself upon a step. Mr. Jasper seats himself upon another. The odour from the wicker bottle, which has somehow passed into Durdles' keeping, soon intimates that the cork has been taken out. But this is not ascertainable through the sense of sight, since neither can descry the other. And yet in talking they turn to one another, as though their faces could commune together.
"This is good stuff, Mr. Jasper."
"It is very good stuff, I hope. I bought it on purpose."
"They don't show, you see, the old uns don't, Mr. Jasper."
"It would be a more confused world than it is, if they could."
"Well, it would lead towards a mixing of things," Durdles acquiesces, pausing on the remark, as if the idea of ghosts had not previously presented itself to him in a merely inconvenient light, domestically or chronologically.
"But do you think there may be ghosts of other things, though not of men and women?"
"What things?" "Flower beds and watering pots? Horses and harness?"
"No. Sounds."
"What sounds?"
"Cries."
"What cries do you mean? Chairs to mend?"
"No, I mean screeches. Now I'll tell you, Mr. Jasper. Wait a bit until I put the bottle right."
Here the cork is evidently taken out again and replaced again.
"There, now it's right. This time last year, only a few days later, I happened to have been doing what was correct by the season, in the way of giving it the welcome it had a right to expect, when them town boys set on me at their worst. At length I gave 'em the slip and turned in here, and here I fell asleep. And what woke me? The ghost of a cry. The ghost of one terrific shriek, which shriek was followed by the ghost of the howl of a dog. A long, dismal, woeful howl, such as a dog gives when a person's dead. That was my last Christmas Eve."
"What do you mean?" is the very abrupt, and one might say fierce, retort.
"I mean that I made inquiries everywhere about, and that no living ears but mine heard either that cry or that howl. So I say they was both ghosts, though why they came to me I've never made out."
"I thought you were another kind of man," says Jasper scornfully.
"So I thought myself," answers Durdles with his usual composure. "And yet I was picked out for it."
Jasper had risen suddenly when he asked him what he meant, and he now says, "Come, we shall freeze here. Lead the way." Durdles complies, not over steadily, opens the door at the top of the steps with the key he has already used, and so emerges on the cathedral level, in a passage at the side of the chancel. Here the moonlight is so very bright again that the colours of the nearest stained-glass window are thrown upon their faces. The appearance of the unconscious Durdles, holding the door open for his companion to follow, as if from the grave, is ghastly enough, with a purple hand across his face and a yellow splash upon his brow. But he bears the close scrutiny of his companion in an insensible way, although it is prolonged while the latter fumbles among his pockets for a key confided to him that will open an iron gate, so to enable them to pass to the staircase of the great tower. "That and the bottle are enough for you to carry," he says, giving it to Durdles. "Hand your bundle to me. I am younger and longer-winded than you." Durdles hesitates for a moment between bundle and bottle, but gives the preference to the bottle as being by far the better company, and consigns the dry weight to his fellow explorer. Then they go up the winding staircase of the great tower, toilsomely turning and turning, and lowering their heads to avoid the stairs above, or the rough stone pivot around which they twist. Durdles has lighted his lantern by drawing from the cold, hard wall a spark of that mysterious fire which lurks in everything, and, guided by this speck, they clamber up among the cobwebs and the dust. Their way lies through strange places. Twice or thrice they emerge into level, low-arched galleries, whence they can look down into the moonlit nave, and where Durdles, waving his lantern, waves the dim angels' heads upon the corbels of the roof, seeming to watch their progress. Anon they turn into narrower and steeper staircases, and the night air begins to blow upon them, and the chirp of some startled jackdaw or frightened rook precedes the heavy beating of wings in a confined space, and the beating down of dust and straws upon their heads. At last, leaving their light behind a stair, for it blows fresh up here, they look down on Cloisterham, fair to see in the moonlight, its ruined habitations and sanctuaries of the dead at the tower's base, its moss-softened red-tiled roofs and red-brick houses of the living clustered beyond, its river winding down from the mist on the horizon, as though that were its source, and already heaving with a restless knowledge of its approach towards the sea. Once again, an unaccountable expedition, this. Jasper, always moving softly with no visible reason, contemplates the scene, and especially that stillest part of it which the cathedral overshadows. But he contemplates Durdles quite as curiously, and Durdles is by times conscious of his watchful eyes. Only by times, because Durdles is growing drowsy. As aeronauts lighten the load they carry when they wish to rise, similarly Durdles has lightened the wicker bottle in coming up. Snatches of sleep surprise him on his legs and stop him in his talk. A mild fit of calenture seizes him, in which he deems that the ground so far below is on a level with the tower, and would as lief walk off the tower into the air as not. Such is his state when they begin to come down. And as aeronauts make themselves heavier when they wish to descend, similarly Durdles charges himself with more liquid from the wicker bottle, that he may come down the better. The iron gate attained and locked, but not before Durdles has tumbled twice, and cut an eyebrow open once, they descend into the crypt again, with the intent of issuing forth as they entered. But while returning among those lanes of light, Durdles becomes so very uncertain, both of foot and speech, that he half drops, half throws himself down by one of the heavy pillars, scarcely less heavy than itself, and indistinctly appeals to his companion for 40 winks of a second each. "If you will have it so, or must have it so," replies Jasper, "I'll not leave you here. Take them while I walk to and fro." Durdles is asleep at once, and in his sleep he dreams a dream. It is not much of a dream, considering the vast extent of the domains of Dreamland and their wonderful productions. It is only remarkable for being unusually restless and unusually real. He dreams of lying there asleep, and yet counting his companion's footsteps as he walks to and fro. He dreams that the footsteps die away into distance of time and of space, and that something touches him, and that something falls from his hand. Then something chinks and gropes about, and he dreams that he is alone for so long a time that the lanes of light take new directions as the moon advances in her course. From succeeding unconsciousness he pauses into a dream of slow uneasiness from cold, and painfully awakes to a perception of the lanes of light really changed, much as he had dreamed, and Jasper walking among them, beating his hands and feet.
"Hallo!"
Durdles cries out, unmeaningly alarmed. "Awake at last?" says Jasper, coming up to him. "Do you know that your forties have stretched into thousands?"
"No."
"They have, though."
"What's the time?"
"Hark, the bells are going in the tower." They strike four quarters, and then the great bell strikes.
"Two?" cries Durdles, scrambling up. "Why didn't you try to wake me, Mr. Jasper?"
"I did. I might as well have tried to wake the dead, your own family of dead, up in the corner there."
"Did you touch me?"
"Touch you? Yes, shook you." As Durdles recalls that touching something in his dream, he looks down on the pavement and sees the key of the crypt door lying close to where he himself lay.
"I dropped you, did I?"
he says, picking it up, and recalling that part of his dream. As he gathers himself up again into an upright position, or into a position as nearly upright as he ever maintains, he is again conscious of being watched by his companion. "Well," says Jasper, smiling, "are you quite ready? Pray don't hurry."
"Let me get my bundle right, Mr. Jasper, and I'm with you."
As he ties it afresh, he is once more conscious that he is very narrowly observed.
"What do you suspect me of, Mr. Jasper?" he asks, with drunken displeasure. "Let them as has any suspicions of Durdles name 'em."
"I've no suspicions of you, my good Mr. Durdles, but I have suspicions that my bottle was filled with something stiffer than either of us supposed." "And I also have suspicions," Jasper adds, taking it from the pavement and turning it bottom upwards, "that it's empty." Durdles condescends to laugh at this, continuing to chuckle when his laugh is over, as though remonstrant with himself on his drinking powers. He rolls to the door and unlocks it. They both pass out, and Durdles relocks it and pockets his key. "A thousand thanks for a curious and interesting night," says Jasper, giving him his hand. "You can make your own way home?"
"I should think so," answers Durdles. "If you was to offer Durdles the affront to show him his way home, he wouldn't go home. Durdles wouldn't go home till morning, and then Durdles wouldn't go home. Durdles wouldn't."
This with the utmost defiance. "Good night, then."
"Good night, Mr. Jasper."
Each is turning his own way, when a sharp whistle rends the silence, and the jargon is yelped out.
"Fiddy, fiddy, ven! I catches him out of ten. Fiddy, fiddy, vi! Then he don't go. Then I shy. Fiddy, fiddy, vate cock, warning!"
Instantly afterwards, a rapid shower of stones rattles at the cathedral wall, and the hideous small boy is beheld opposite, dancing in the moonlight.
"What, is that baby devil on the watch there?"
cries Jasper in a fury, so quickly roused and so violent that he seems an older devil himself.
"I shall shed the blood of that impish wretch. I know I shall do it."
Regardless of the fire, though it hits him more than once. He rushes at Deputy, collars him, and tries to bring him across. But Deputy is not to be so easily brought across. With a diabolical insight into the strongest part of his position, he is no sooner taken by the throat than he curls up his legs, forces his assailant to hang him, as it were, and gurgles in his throat, and screws his body, and twists, as already undergoing the first agonies of strangulation. There is nothing for it but to drop him. He instantly gets himself together, backs over to Durdles, and cries to his assailant, gnashing the great gap in front of his mouth with rage and malice,
"I'll blind you, s'help me! I'll stone your eyes out, s'help me! If I don't have your eyesight, bellows me!"
At the same time dodging behind Durdles, and snarling at Jasper, now from this side of him, and now from that, prepared, if pounced upon, to dart away in all manner of curvilinear directions, and, if run down after all, to grovel in the dust and cry,
"Now, hit me when I'm down, do it!"
"Don't hurt the boy, Mr. Jasper," urges Durdles, shielding him. "Recollect yourself. He followed us to-night, when we first came here."
"You lie, I didn't,"
replies Deputy, in his one form of polite contradiction.
"He has been prowling near us ever since."
"You lie, I haven't," returns Deputy. "I only just come out for me elf when I see you two are coming out of the confederal. If I catches him out at 10,
with the usual rhythm and dance, though dodging behind Durdles,
"it ain't any fault, is it?"
"Take him home, then,"
retorts Jasper ferociously, though with a strong check upon himself,
"and let my eyes be rid of the sight of you."
Deputy, with another sharp whistle, at once expressing his relief and his commencement of a milder stoning of Mr. Durdles, begins stoning that respectable gentleman home, as if he were a reluctant ox. Mr. Jasper goes to his gatehouse brooding. And thus, as everything comes to an end, the unaccountable expedition comes to an end, for this time. End of chapter 12. Read by Alan Chant of Tunbridge in Kent, England, during March 2008.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.